Welcome to the Not Old, Better Show. I'm Paul Vogelsang. My guest today is Charles Duhigg, and in this segment of the Not Old, Better Show, we'll talk to the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and New York Times investigative reporter about his new book, Smarter, Faster, Better. In the book, Charles Duhigg talks about motivation, goal setting, and decision making, and why some people get so much done. As always, here on the Not Old, Better Show, we'll focus on how those in the 50-plus age community can learn, hone, refine our skill set, despite some of the economic forces thrown our way.
There's a fundamental debate going on about what productivity is, how you define productivity, how you gauge or evaluate someone's productivity, and particularly for baby boomers, for people who are nearing retirement age but are not at retirement age, there's a lot of questions about how do I remain competitive? How do I find the job that seems satisfying and the life that seems satisfying as the world changes around me? Because I don't have time to completely reinvent myself, but I certainly want to stay at the top of my game, and I want to be someone who employers and friends and colleagues desire to work with and to spend time with.
Charles Duhigg's newest book, called Smarter, Faster, Better, explores the science of productivity. Being busy is not the same as being productive. In fact, that's an important distinction, particularly now, today, as it's easier and easier to be busy, and that does not mean that you're necessarily becoming more productive. The most productive people, in fact, often understand that distinction, and they go out of their way to try and not be busy, but to do the things that actually matter. For the Not Old, Better audience, we'll learn this science of productivity and how to succeed with less stress and struggle.
But this is kind of the point, is that the people who are most productive and most successful tend to be those people who have practices in their life that give them the time to think about what productivity actually is, what their most important goals are, how they stay focused on those goals, what their priorities ought to be.
Charles Duhigg is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the New York Times and the author of the bestseller, The Power of Habit. He is the winner of the National Academies of Sciences, National Journalism, and George Polk Awards. He's a graduate of the Harvard Business School and Yale College. He lives in Brooklyn with his wife and two children. One of the book's best stories is of the creative process around the hit Disney movie Frozen, and how the movie, which almost didn't happen, ultimately came together because Disney found the right creative process. Creativity and productive creativity is about having the right process in place, a creative process that helps people understand how to take the ideas that they know are real and meaningful and to use them in new ways.
You know, we all know this movie Frozen as a movie that is a huge blockbuster, but what most people don't know is that it was actually on the brink of catastrophe until just weeks before it appeared in theaters.
It's a wonderful book, and we'll put an excerpt to Smarter, Faster, Better in the notes for you, courtesy of Random House and Charles Duhigg. If you enjoyed this episode with Charles Duhigg of the Not Old, Better Show, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Not Old, Better Show, please find us at notoldbetter.com. Please join me today in welcoming Charles Duhigg.
Welcome to the Not Old, Better Podcast. It's time for this week's featured guest on the Not Old, Better Podcast. And now your host, Paul Vogelsang.
Well, Charles, let's jump right in because I am so pleased to be talking with you. I think one of the reasons for my excitement around the book, again, the title Smarter, Faster, Better, is because the title of my show is Not Old, Better. And my listeners, who will be fascinated by the book too, know that the show focuses on being better, and that's something that your book does such a great job in describing. We'll certainly talk about some of the great stories in the book, but something that I was struck with immediately is how much the book relates to my audience, to the 50-plus age audience, and how your principles of situational awareness, visualization, being productive are all things, by your definitions, that are areas where the 50-plus age community could be great assets, because
we might possess some of these things already, and we can certainly learn and hone from your principles. But you know, due to the economy, the gig economy, contract labor, many of those in the kind of the 50 plus age community are facing some of these challenges, and they want to be better, and they want to do a better job. And my whole point is have some confidence. Many of these changes, you in the 50 plus age community, you can deal with because you kind of have some of the tools already. And so I wonder, in terms of the book, what your reaction to that might be.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, one of the reasons why I wrote the book is because we're living through this economic revolution, right? And I think in retrospect, the economists at this point pretty much agree that we will see this period as profound an economic and social change as the Industrial Revolution and the Agrarian Revolution. And one of the things about an economic revolution like this is that it's a very anxiety-producing experience to live through, right?
Yes.
In retrospect, it seems kind of romantic, but when you're living through it, it's really hard. And one of the things that's happening is that as our economy is changing and as our world is changing, there's a fundamental debate going on about what productivity is, how you define productivity, how you gauge or evaluate someone's productivity, particularly for baby boomers, for people who are nearing retirement age but are not at retirement age. There's a lot of questions about how do I remain competitive? How do I find the job that seems satisfying and the life that seems satisfying as the world changes around me? Because I don't have time to completely reinvent myself, but I certainly want to stay at the top of my game, and I want to be someone who employers and friends and colleagues desire to work with and to spend time with. And that's really why I wrote the book, is to try and figure out what are those skills, those characteristics, which are disproportionately valuable today because the world is changing.
And let's go there for a second, because productivity gets a bad rap in general, but I think for those age 50 and over, you know, it's almost comparatively, employers use this as maybe the reason for not hiring us. And you have this very different, unique definition of productivity. How do you define being productive?
Well, I think that in general, productivity is one of those things that is very dependent on the person who's defining it, right? So one of the things that we know is that the most productive people are people who spend an unusual amount of time thinking about what the definition of productivity ought to be for them and trying to figure out how that definition changes from situation to situation and even day to day. A productive Wednesday morning, for instance, might be one where you get your kids to school as early as possible, or you get out of the house as fast as you can and you get to your desk and you sort of power through all the emails you got to get done. But a productive Friday morning might be one where you get up and you go for a jog and you're not stressed about making it to your desk before 8:30 because you know that you're on top of things. And a productive weekend, obviously, is very different from a productive weekday. But this is kind of the point, is that the people who are most productive and most successful tend to be those people who have practices in their life that give them the time to think about what productivity actually is, what their most important goals are, how they stay focused on those goals, what their priorities ought to be, how they generate self-motivation and sharpen their attention. Within the academic literature, these are referred to as contemplative routines, basically ways that people can force more deeper thinking into their life. And it doesn't have to be much deeper, right? What we know is that the people who are most successful tend to just kind of think half an inch more deeply about these questions, but that half an inch ends up making all the difference.
Yeah, and I think one of the great stories that I liked so much in the book that was the story about the Qantas flight 32 from Singapore to Sydney, where I think it's Captain Richard D. Krepney. He experiences some unbelievable engine problems, but he has the time, he has the pause maybe to think. So tell us a little bit about that plane ride where everything just goes terribly wrong.
Yeah, so this is a great story, and it's actually very little known outside of Australia. So Qantas Flight 32 took off from the Singapore airport in 2010, and it was headed to Sydney, Australia. And it was being flown by Richard de Krebny, who was a pilot who had been trained in the Australian military. And about 20 minutes into their flight, when they're at about 12,500 feet, there's this bang from one of the engines. And then the sound like thousands of marbles being thrown against the hull or fuselage of the plane. And what had happened, unbeknownst to the pilots, is that in one of the engines, and this is a huge plane, it's an Airbus A380. It's like one of those double-decker planes where each engine is like basically, you know, is almost as big as a house, or at least an apartment. So in one of the engines, there had been a small fire that had broken out, and it had caused one of the fan blades on that engine to detach from the shaft. And as that fan blade detached from the shaft, it started shooting through the wing, and it poked this huge hole in the wing, big enough for a person's body to fit through. But that's not actually the bad thing that happened during this flight. The bad thing that happened is that as that fan blade was shooting through the wing, it hit another fan blade, and it caused that fan blade to explode into thousands of pieces. And that was like the shrapnel from a bomb going off inside that wing. As all those shards from that exploded fan blade moved through the wing, they cut through electrical lines and hydraulic lines and fuel lines. Within just minutes, 22 of the 24 systems that are required to keep a plane aloft were suddenly knocked out. It's actually the worst mid-air mechanical disaster in modern aviation history. Within the cockpit, Richard Krebny and his co-pilots, there's all these alarms going off, right? And they have no idea what's happening. Like, this all happens within minutes. And they discovered that the plane has become almost impossible to pilot. Now, one of the interesting things about Richard Krebny is that he was a big believer in what's known as situational awareness, which is a way of thinking when you're flying planes in which you essentially build mental models about what you expect to happen. Or put differently, you tell yourself a story about what you anticipate will occur. Because that helps you process information as it comes in and decide what to pay attention to and what to ignore. Mental models are actually at the core of how our brain creates focus and directs our attention. And Richard Krebny was so into this idea of building mental models that oftentimes, and he did this on Qantas Flight 32, before the flight, like when they were taking the van from the hotel to the airport, he would quiz his co-pilots on basically forcing them to tell him stories about what they would do in case of an emergency. So he'd say, you know, tell me if engine 2 was to go out, like, what's the first words out of your mouth? Where are you going to put your hand? Where's the first place that your eyes are going to go? Tell me a story about what will happen in case if we lose the left engine. And the reason why he did this is because he wanted to create this mental narrative, this mental model, a story that people were telling themselves about how they would react in case of an emergency. And so when they have this problem with the exploded fan blade, or engine blades, that's exactly what happens. For the first 10 minutes, if you listen to the cockpit recordings from this flight, it's almost as if these pilots are reading from a script. They speak in calm, short sentences. Everyone kind of responds exactly if they're supposed to in an emergency situation. And in most cases, that would be all that was necessary to save this plane. But the problem with Qantas Flight 32 is that the damage caused by this accident was so profound that there was essentially no mental model that was complex enough to capture what was going on. And so as soon as they would, for instance, solve one problem, five more problems would pop up. And they would solve two of those by going through the scripts. And then 10 more problems would emerge. There was no way for anyone to tell themselves a story about what was happening that could capture the full complexity of all the problems this plane was having. System after system was failing as the minutes passed. And so Richard Krebny, about 15 minutes in, he does something really interesting. He's sitting in the cockpit. He's been dealing with all these emergencies. He's in kind of high panic mode. And he feels himself getting sucked into what's known as a cognitive tunnel. Now, cognitive tunnel is something that all of us have experienced. It's when you just start reacting to prompts that are around you instead of thinking about what you ought to do. When you're going down the road and you're not speeding, but you see a cop car out of the corner of your eye and you suddenly slam on your brakes even though you don't need to, that's a cognitive tunnel. That's you reacting instead of making a decision. And particularly in emergency situations, those cognitive tunnels are really, really dangerous. Because what they can do is they can cause us to stop thinking, stop making decisions, and simply react to the most obvious stimuli that's right in front of our eyes. And Krebny feels himself falling into this cognitive tunnel. So what he does is he closes his eyes, he takes his hands off the controls, and he thinks to himself, I need a new mental model. I need a simpler story to help me determine where to put my attention and what I can ignore. I need something to help me make decisions. And so he decides to start envisioning this flight as a Cessna. Now, a Cessna, for anyone who's ever flown on one, is this small, almost like a toy plane compared to an Airbus A380. They have almost nothing in common, except that a Cessna is the plane that Krebny had learned to fly on. And a Cessna, like every airplane, has these three basic components. There's a navigation system. There's the ability to go up and down in the air, and there's landing gear. And when de Crespigny starts thinking about this flight as a Cessna, it gives him a mental model that allows his attention, his focus, to almost instantaneously determine what to pay attention to and what to ignore. If an emergency corresponded to the kind of emergency that he would have in a Cessna, then it's worth his attention. If it's more complicated than that, if it doesn't have to do with the story of a Cessna in his brain, then he can put it aside. He's not going to pay attention to it. So by now they've managed to turn the plane around and they're headed back to the Singapore airport and they're approaching the runway. And as they approach the runway, a type of alarm goes off called a squealer that's actually been designed so that pilots can't ignore it. It's so loud and so shrill that if a pilot is almost passed out, it will actually revive them. And it's considered kind of the alarm of last resort. And as they're approaching the runway, the squealer goes off, and de Crespigny actually turns to his co-pilots and he says, ignore that alarm. Because in his brain, he's flying a Cessna. And in the Cessna, there's no squealer going off. He has the three things that he knows that he needs to pay attention to, this navigation, going up and down, and the landing gear. He comes down and he approaches the runway and they touch down on the tarmac. And the runway is 2,000 feet long. And if they overshoot the runway, if they don't brake fast enough, the wheels will dig into these sand dunes that surround the runway and the plane will likely flip over. But in his mind, de Crespigny's flying this Cessna. And the thing about a Cessna is that you only have to brake a Cessna once. You just hold the brake pedal down and you just let the plane slow. And so that's what he does. He holds the brake pedal down. The metal of the plane starts to groan as it struggles with the speed. They're getting closer and closer to the end of the runway. And they eventually stop with 100 meters to spare. And 45 minutes later, all 469 people on board that plane safely got off. Now, what's crazy about this, it's remarkable. What's crazy about it is that they've tried to recreate that landing hundreds of times in simulators. And every single time, the plane crashes. And so there's this fundamental question, why was de Crespigny able to land this plane? And I'm not certain, and neither is he for that matter, that it's because he was envisioning the plane as a Cessna. Right? There might have been 100 other reasons. Maybe he got lucky. Maybe he could have thought of that plane as a Cessna and it would have been exactly the wrong thing to do. Maybe there was 1,000 choices that he wasn't even aware he was making that were critical to landing that plane. But what's important is that if you talk to de Crespigny, and I've spoken to him a number of times, what he'll tell you is the worst decision he could have made, the worst thing that could have happened, is for him to stop making choices, to allow his focus and his attention to be dominated by whatever alarm is going off in front of his eyes. For when that squealer goes off, for him to ignore everything else around him and start responding to the squealer and start dealing with whatever emergency it's signaling. That would have been disastrous because he would have been simply reacting rather than making choices. And what was critical at that moment was to allow his attention, his focus, to determine what deserves focus and what he can safely ignore. And there was something about having this story in his head of the Cessna that allowed him to parse out where he wanted to focus and where he wanted to let things just sit by the side. And that's what made the difference in allowing him to land that plane. Now, when you think about the modern office that most of us go into, it's not that dissimilar from like the cockpit of a plane during an emergency, right? You walk into work and like your phone is buzzing in your pocket and there's 150 emails waiting for you and there's someone coming by your office asking if you can come to this meeting all of a sudden and someone else is calling you up and asking for advice on how to deal with something. The hardest thing to do at work is to figure out, what's my priority? What should I focus on and what can I safely ignore? And the way that we do this well, the way that we make a decision instead of simply reacting, is to have some mental model, to tell ourselves a story of what we expect to occur during our day, what our biggest goal is that we actually want to focus on. That's how we train our brain to say, I'm going to pay attention to this phone call, I'm going to return these three emails, and everything else, I'm just going to ignore because it doesn't fit into the mental model of how I expected today to unfold.
This notion of calm, whether it was a choice by de Crespigny or just instinct, that also seems to be an important element in all of this, and one that lends itself also, I think, to the 50 plus community. Not that we have a corner on that market necessarily, but I think the Google story about the team assembly of just exactly the right team, and that oftentimes the smartest people being jammed together isn't necessarily the most productive team, but that perhaps the group dynamics for safety and this idea of situational awareness and social sensitivity, that those components are more important than maybe a diverse team, maybe a more diverse age group type team might be a better team and might allow for just some people being comfortable and kind of thinking outside the box, which is certainly what DeCrepney did.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we know is that diversity on teams tends to lead to much better team performance. And the reason why is because if you think about it, what a team is supposed to provide is it's supposed to provide multiple viewpoints on a problem that come together and create some solution that no individual could arrive at on their own. Now, if you have a bunch of individuals who are all think the same way and have the same experiences, then putting them together on the team doesn't really add much, right? It's basically just a group of individuals who come together and sort of distribute work. And oftentimes they do it very inefficiently because you'll assign two people to something that one person could do on their own. But if you have a real diversity of perspectives, then suddenly you have different ideas coming together. And those ideas tend to inform each other in surprising serendipitous ways. But the key is that people have to have different ideas. So if you have someone who's 25-year-old and someone who's 55-year-old who are both on a team together and approaching a problem, then they're much more likely to come up with a better solution because they're going to have different experiences that they're bringing to the problem.
You know, one of those serendipitous moments certainly was around the movie Frozen in your book. And you talk about that so well, that story was really one of almost creative folly, that it really almost didn't happen, except that Disney was able to recreate kind of a team around this idea of some experiences shared by some sisters.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So one of the things that happened is that, you know, we all know this movie Frozen as a movie that is a huge blockbuster. But what most people don't know is that it was actually on the brink of catastrophe until just weeks before it appeared in theaters. And the way that they figured out how to make this movie work is that they were struggling with what the story ought to be because they had all these different iterations of a Snow Queen who would attack a town and a young girl who lived in the town who defended her family. And none of it was really working. It seemed so cliched and hackneyed. And so they had this big meeting and they sat everyone down and they said, look, we at Disney, we believe that creativity is a process. It's not that some people are creative and others aren't, or that some people are artists and others don't have creative insights. It's that if you have the right process in place, anyone can be creative. And at the core of this process is this belief that drawing on your own personal experiences, finding things that seem emotionally authentic to you, leads you to some type of creative insight. And so they said, look, we need to figure out what are the ideas that we're really trying to talk about in this movie. And someone said, well, first of all, princesses, right? Because Disney knows princesses. Like, we know how to tell princess stories better than anyone else. This can't just be a normal princess story because we've told that 1,000 times. It's so picked over. We need another idea to combine with princesses. Now, one of the interesting things about Frozen is that there were an unusually large number of women on the filmmaking team that made Frozen. In fact, the co-director was the first female director in Disney's history. And if they're talking about this, what's the second idea that they can draw on? Something that seems emotionally authentic. Someone said, well, what about sisters? Because the thing about sisterhood is that anyone who has a sister, they know that it's not usually that, like, there's one evil sister and one good sister. It's that sisters are kind of equally messed up, right? And they grow apart, and then they become friends again, and then they, you know, fall out of touch. And that's interesting. Sisters are kind of interesting, particularly if you have a sister yourself. It's a complicated relationship. And so someone said, look, what if we took these two ideas? What if we took the idea of princesses and the idea of sisters, and we joined them together? And once you do that, suddenly all these creative opportunities open up. Because now, instead of having the prince save the princess, you can have the princesses be sisters who save each other. And then that means that the prince can actually be the bad guy. But you don't have to reveal that till the end of the movie. Suddenly you have all of these creative opportunities because you find these ideas that seem emotionally authentic and you push them together in unexpected ways. And that's what creativity actually is.
One of my favorite stories in the book, too, is about the study of the nursing homes. And they try to answer this question. And, you know, it's really kind of about being better. You know, well, I think the question is, why do some people that enter nursing homes pass away relatively quickly and others seem to thrive? And you use this term that I think is so great. You call these people subversives. I definitely have known some subversives in my own family. Tell us a little bit about the subversives here.
Well, so one of the things that we know about motivation is that people who tend to seek out opportunities for control tend to do a better job at self-motivating. And a lot of these studies come from nursing homes, as you mentioned. Particularly, there was this question about why some people would enter nursing homes and they would really do well. They would sort of prosper. Their health would improve. And other people would enter nursing homes who basically had the same situation, and they would begin declining almost immediately and would pass away relatively quickly. Because when you think about it, a nursing home ought to be a place where people thrive, right? You're surrounded by medical resources in a nursing home. It's a place where you ought to be more healthy, but only some people would become more healthy when they entered. And so researchers started interviewing nursing home residents, and what they found was that the people who were particularly successful within nursing homes, they were people who tried to find ways to essentially break the rules. And that's why they referred to them as subversives. And one of my favorite examples, they did a series of interviews with residents of this one nursing home. And they talked to this one guy. And in this nursing home, every resident would get like a pre-served meal, right? You'd go into the cafeteria and they'd give you a tray with your meal on it. And they talked to this one guy who said that he loved chocolate cake. And that every night the cafeteria would give him a piece of chocolate cake. But then instead of eating that chocolate cake, he would trade it with someone else for like fruit or some other desserts. And they asked him, why? Why are you doing this? Like, you said you love chocolate cake. And he said, you know, I would rather eat a meal of my own design than consume something I love that's forced on me. And that kind of gets at this idea of how subversives think, that they're people who look for ways to prove to themselves that they're still in control of their own life. And if you believe that you're in control of your own life, then you believe that you have power to make choices. And if you believe that you have power to make choices, then it's easier to start motivating for things like exercise or for developing relationships with your peers or for keeping in touch with your family. And we know that things like exercise and believing you're in control of your own life, those are things that allow people to thrive, to do well within a nursing home setting. And that's exactly why it's important, is that you have to find ways to prove to yourself that you're in control if you want to self-motivate for all those things that keep us young and healthy and fit.
Yeah, these ideas of self-motivation and daydreaming, contemplation, that they've been really very powerfully brought home in the book. Again, the name of the book by Charles Duhigg is Smarter, Faster, Better. I love this story about some of these diaries that have been written from 40 or 50 years ago about people who they mention in the diary that they might have been standing in line and they had this great idea. I think I've read that you talked also about Saturday Night Live, Lorne Michaels meeting Chevy Chase because they were standing online, you know, waiting to see, I think it was Monty Python. And we don't do that anymore because we're so actively engaged, and maybe contemplation is a good thing today, maybe a little bit of moment of reflection. So talk a little bit about that.
You're exactly right. Sort of the idea underlying all of the concepts in Smarter, Faster, Better. And you know, there's these eight kind of concepts or these eight skills that we now know are disproportionately important these days in helping people be productive and successful. But the idea underlying all eight of those concepts is that the more that we teach ourselves to think deeply, the more successful we end up becoming, right? We all only have 24 hours in each day. There's no like magic wand that allows some people to work, you know, many more hours than everyone else. So the question isn't how hard you're working. The question is how smart you're working. Are you focusing on the right goals? Are you paying attention to the right priorities? Are you motivating yourself? Are you being creative in ways that we know tend to generate more ideas? And a lot of that has to do with how much time do you have to think? Are you forcing yourself to think just half an inch deeper than everyone else? You know, thinking half an inch deeper than everyone else, that's not a big burden. It's not a big obstacle, but most of us are so busy that we don't have time to think now. You know, when we stand online, instead of letting our mind wander, we check our iPhone and we return emails or we surf the web. We don't have downtime anymore or time where we're just contemplative. And the people who are most successful are the ones who force that contemplative time into their days and their routines, because that allows them to figure out, what should I really be focusing on? What's the big idea as opposed to the small, busy work? If you can be less busy, you can become more productive.
That's good, Charles. Thank you so much. Charles Duhigg, the author of Smarter, Faster, Better, The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and Business, has been our guest. Charles, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Good luck. We'll put links to the book and an excerpt from one of the chapters. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.